Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, the 27th of June, year 2000. We are in the VC this morning with Paul Warren. Today's session number is WAP 2000-2 and is entitled, We Can Work It Out, Fighting Our Way Towards Greater Intimacy. Let's listen in.
Greatly affected in those first couple of years because they're observing everything. As you've seen, if you've ever seen an infant and a toddler, they're taking in the world like a sponge. And they're constantly taking in images of how people relate to each other in relationship to one another, their significant caregivers. And the imago is not just their mother or father, but it's the significant people in their lives, siblings, grandparents, friends of the family, and it comprises this overall picture of the imago. And it greatly influences how the choices we make as an adult, even though we make them very unconsciously. It seems like frequently young adults make rather unconscious choices, and sometimes like in first marriages. And you wonder if you ever heard a story of, say, for instance, a girl who was raised in a family with an abusive alcoholic father. Why on earth do they go off and they end up marrying abusive people or alcoholics or whatever? Why does that happen? It's the imago. It's the unconscious mind that's involved in these choices we make. It's what we just know that love is all about, right? So Harmer Hendrix's Getting the Love You Want is an excellent book to work with, either in your own self-exploration or with your partner. A very, very good book. Another book that I recommend a lot for people, if you haven't read the book The Road Less Traveled by Scott Peck, I just think that's one of the single most helpful self-help books you can read. And it was a very eye-opening book for me, too. As we talk, there are other books, too, I'll recommend that just kind of throw out there for you.
Excuse me, who was the author of the first one, Getting the Love You Want?
Harville Hendrix.
Uh-huh.
Harville Hendrix.
H-E-N-D-R-I-X.
Yeah.
Kind of
like...
Harville, kind of...
Harville. He's not related to Jimi Hendrix, in case you're wondering.
Well, he probably is.
That's right, Keeping Love. I haven't read that one, but Keeping the Love
We
Fine.
We didn't see that in the bookstore.
Mm-hmm. Did everybody get this first handout that went around? The same thing called breath prayers? You can pass those around back there. This is a nice little, I think it's very important for us when we're talking about conflict, as we're going to be talking about today, it's extremely important for us to be centered people when it comes to conflict. Any of you ever have the experience of getting kind of anxious and afraid or just too emotionally stirred up in conflict? Who has not had that experience? All of us have. Have you ever noticed how it kind of makes you kind of, it certainly makes you less effective in conflict, that the best way to be effective is to try and stay centered as much as possible? You know, in martial arts, my son is a black belt in Taekwondo. He's taken martial arts for many years, and he knows how to center himself really well. To center yourself is to breathe from your center and to be aware of your center. So as you're sitting there right now, I would just like for you to be aware of your center. And right there, it's kind of your center of gravity point. Some people who are singers know how to breathe from their diaphragm. That's what you have to do as a singer. But most people breathe improperly. Most people, when you tell them to take a deep breath, watch them. They breathe from their chest and shoulders. And you can tell because when you tell them, when they take a deep breath, their shoulders rise and their chest goes out like that, right? Is where they're breathing from. If we want to be relaxed, centered people, we breathe from our diaphragm down here. And when you inhale, your stomach goes out. And when you exhale, it's all down here. And if you want to reduce your anxiety, that's what you do. You take a deep breath from your center and really work on that. For people who are not good at breathing from their diaphragm, one way to practice that at home is to lay down on your back on the floor and put a book on your stomach.
Telephone directory.
Or telephone directory would be good. Yeah, it's a nice, heavy, large object. And when you inhale, the book should go up, right? Just practice making that book go up and down. And sometimes when you're in front of the mirror, take a deep breath. Watch where you're breathing from, because you really have to retrain yourself to breathe properly. I think for some females, this is more of a problem because they have this thing, you know, our culture has poisoned females to believe that they're supposed to, their bodies are supposed to look a certain way, and that means having a small stomach, doesn't it? And that's why we have, you know, problems with eating disorders so much too. It's important to know that it's okay to exhale and let your stomach go out. You know, breathe from your center. These breath prayers are very helpful ways of a simple kind of Christian meditation, basically. Meditation is just a method of relaxation where you kind of clear the slate, all the clutter on your blackboard and your brain, and you want to clear that. So when you take a deep breath, when you inhale, you can say the first half of any one of these breath prayers, and when you exhale, slowly in your own mind, you say the second half of the breath prayer. I like now the silence, now the peace. And we can try that just a couple times, if you will. Just as you inhale. And with each exhalation, really focus on just letting the tension go. Taking a nice deep breath in. Now the silence, now the peace. Breathing easy and deeply. Focusing if there's any tension, letting that go with each exhalation. Feeling yourself just kind of let go and feel the chair underneath you. And when you're relaxed, you can just open your eyes. We're not going to go into a deep trance or anything here today. But you can see that just doing that for a moment really is very effective, isn't it? Very effective way of centering yourself. Doesn't take long at all. Thank you for the hands over there. Because true power, striving for healthy empowerment, is about being centered and calm. Knowing that, as if any of you heard Rabbi Marks this morning, he was talking about how the voice of God is one that is gentle and calm, that kind of presence. And that's what we strive for when we understand what true empowerment is all about. When I watch two people argue, which I frequently do in marriage counseling, I see that the person who's really the most stirred up and yelling or raising their voice the most isn't the most powerful person to me. But our culture has really taught that power is about domination, isn't it? Walter Wink wrote another very good book if you're interested in the whole issue of power and trying to sort out what healthy power is from what sick power is. He wrote a book called Engaging the Powers. That's an excellent book. And healthy power is more of a calm presence that seeks, as we said yesterday, those of you who were here, it's not about controlling others, but it's about being influential with those who are willing to be influenced, right? It's about letting go of control. Whereas our domination system that we've been raised with is about force. It's about dominating over, oppressing. It's about yelling and screaming. It's about winning the war, isn't it? And I think males in particular, we are subjugated to this at a very young age. This whole view of power for men is about domination. It's about winning. It's about not being vulnerable. It's about obliterating the opponent. We see this in the John Wayne movies we grew up with, didn't we? We see this in the media, we see it in sports and all the things. So I think men have a struggle with that more and need to really work at that a little bit harder at times. Whereas women have a struggle too with the whole issue of power, because the whole idea of power sometimes takes on a kind of a negative connotation, doesn't it? If you view power as being oppressive, it may not be something that you strive for, even though healthy power is the way to really kind of continue to grow spiritually and be able to handle these things in relationships. Because as we move toward true intimacy through the stages, as we try and achieve moments of true intimacy, I believe the only way we can have true intimacy with any other human being is to have a sense of equal empowerment. Can't be intimate with somebody that you dominate or someone that you're being oppressed by, can you? It is just not possible. So the healthier that we're trying to become ourselves, understanding empowerment, striving for that, and our partner is doing the same, the more we are capable of achieving true intimacy. So the focus today is on the second stage of conflict, which is a problem for most of us. Conflict is something that a lot of people avoid. Conflict is something that a lot of people don't do well. When you hear the word conflict, what comes up for you?
Tension.
Tension?
Like physically
tense. You might even tense up. Very good. Physically, you might tense up. What else comes up for you with conflict when you just hear that word?
Stern. Something you have to avoid.
Hold on a second.
Stern.
Pardon?
Stern.
Stern. Stern. You might have to deal with either yourself or other people being stern. Yes, ma'am.
Something I want to avoid.
Something you want to avoid. Conflict avoidance is pretty common, isn't it?
Danger.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger, tension, avoidance, stern.
Losing,
abandonment.
Problem.
Any of you ever fear abandonment when you get into a conflict? You can just feel your power just oozing out of your body. You lose power that way, don't you? In the conflict when you fear abandonment. And that's kind of one of the core ingredients of the overused term codependency of the 70s and 80s, you know? Still applies, but a very key ingredient to codependency is that fear of abandonment and not wanting to deal with head-on conflict. And it's hard for us to love other people when we're fearing abandonment, isn't it? Hard for us to truly love. Someone else have another comment?
Problem?
Lots of problems. So today I'm going to give you just kind of some ideas on to keep in mind with conflict. One of the primary ideas I want you to just really work on with yourself is you need to reframe. Reframe is just kind of like change the meaning. And you need to really work at reframing the whole idea of conflict for yourself. You need to reframe it in such a way that you start to embrace conflict. That you start to see it as a very vital, necessary part of your relationship. As a very healthy thing. Not abusive conflict, not frustrating conflict that goes nowhere. But you need to come to see that conflict is a very vital, necessary part of intimacy, and you need to strive for that. You need to get to that point where even if you, like they say in AA, you have to fake it till you make it. You ever heard that phrase? I love that. Fake it till you make it. Because in your heart, in your guts, when you get into a conflict, you're still going to be tense. You're still going to be fearing abandonment. You're going to be scared, all those things. You're going to want to avoid it. But in your mind, this is where you have to, your mind needs to lead first. You need to be telling yourself, reassuring self-talk would be, you know, conflict is necessary. This is a growthful thing for me. I need to embrace this. I need to move through it. Hot dogs, here comes a fight. You need to be able to say to yourself in a way that just reassures you and encourages you along, because it's really, we can be frightened people, can't we? And when children are frightened over something that they haven't done very well before, or they haven't done at all, if they know that this is something very necessary for them to learn, they will talk their way into doing it. Have you ever noticed that about kids? How does a child learn to ride a bicycle? How does a child learn how to swim? It's all kind of scary stuff for most of us. Do you remember that, when you learned to do these things? And what did you have to say to yourself to do it? I can do it. I must do this. I don't want to be the only kid on the block that doesn't ride a bicycle. You know? You have to tell yourself, I can do this. It's necessary. So as adults, we need to kind of find that same kind of reassuring self-talk that as kids we may have had. And encourage ourselves for these things. So that's the first thing about conflict I really want you to think about, is the necessity of reframing the meaning of it. Now, another thing about conflict that is really important is the issue that, you know, when we go into war, we developed at the end, I guess it was at the end of World War I, we developed the Geneva Convention. Basically, in order to have a fair fight, you have to have rules, don't you?
very necessary thing. Yeah, I don't want to fight with anyone. I don't want to wrestle. I don't want to box. I don't want to do anything like that with someone who's going to be breaking rules, fighting dirty. So it's very important in, well, we need two more up here. I'm sorry. Hopefully we have enough of these to go around. If we don't, you might want to share one. Very important if you're going to engage in a good fight, a worthy fight, that both people observe the rules of fair fighting. One of the things I recommend for you to do is to, like if I give you these handouts or whatever, if you'd like to, you might think about getting a little notebook. And what I recommend frequently for couples, actually I need to hang on to one, but I'll just slip out yours there.
Here, you can have this one.
Okay.
I was going
to
give one away.
I recommend to couples that you have a notebook, and that you can even, you're bold about it. On the cover of the notebook, you're going to put conflict resolution notebook, or call it whatever you want, fair fighting journal or something. And you can put these handouts in there. And with couples counseling, I recommend that they, you know, have that journal out somewhere in your home. Don't hide it. Don't throw it in a drawer and be embarrassed about it. But keep it out there. And be very intentional in how you approach conflict and how you are striving to become conflict resolution specialists, you know, just experts at it. So be out there with it, right? Stick these handouts in there. Then when you have a conflict, you can even take your notebook out and you've got your rules right there. So let's go over some of these rules of fair fighting. First one, be specific about what is bothering you. A big problem in fighting is that people get real vague and global, and they label and they do all these things, and it's really important fairly early on in an argument that someone take the responsibility of defining what the argument's about. What is this fight specifically about? What is the issue? So that, because, you know, it's pretty common. Have you ever had an argument where you stray off the thing and you go on to two or three or four or five other subjects and you forget even what started the fight? What an exercise in futility, isn't it, to do that? Well, one person, take the responsibility of defining this is the conflict so that you can at least be specific about it. Specific meaning, think in terms, if you can, behaviorally. As a psychologist, I like to think behaviorally. What specific behavior is going on here? So that I don't get too vague as an intuitive. I tend to be kind of vague. And I need to really ground it in what is the actual behavior that's going on here that's a disagreement all about. Number two, sounds very obvious, doesn't it? No name calling. But it is tempting at times for some to get into some name calling, kind of some kind of global label that you put on the other person, which does nothing constructive at all, does it? So I think these are kind of rules that need to be stated, even if you don't do it, even if you're not the type of person who name calls. It helps to have this stated. No past history, stay current. It's very frustrating and defeating to have a lot of past history brought up in an argument too, isn't it? And I think if we're going to be proactive people who are very solution focused, it's one of the things we do now in therapy is we are solution focused. It's about staying with the specific subject and staying current to that moment and not trying to bring up a lot of past history. I think that the only time it's appropriate to bring up much past history is if maybe you're wanting to suggest this is a pattern of behavior I have seen for you, you know? Sometimes that is useful to make a point that this is, I see this going on here, and specific to this behavior, I have seen this as a pattern of behavior for you. Number four, be ready to listen as well as to talk. Listening is a kind of a lost art in our culture at times. In fact, it seems like it's kind of coming back into vogue, isn't it, now? I've heard this lately, people are talking more about the importance of listening, seeking to understand the other person. And if you get into an argument with a family, and you've got more than just a couple people, it's really easy to get into interrupting each other. Do you ever do that? You ever find that you are rehearsing your response to that person while they're still talking, and therefore you're not listening to them at that time? Slow down. And there are simple methods to do that, to kind of ground yourself into not interrupting. We have a joke in our family, because we have four kids,
that, and these kids can all get going and talking at the same time, so we have to slow them down. And it started when we first, this is a blended family that we've had for nearly 5 years, so these were kids who were used to being in families of just two children, now they have four all at the same time. So communication took some work. And the first time we did this, there was a bottle of mustard on the table, and I grabbed the mustard and I said, okay, whoever is holding this mustard is the speaker. Everybody else needs to listen. So, and we would pass the mustard around, and it became kind of a nice story, a joke for our family, that whoever has the mustard is the speaker. Simple thing is that, to take turns in talking, is that you can identify a concrete object. It can be anything. And that whoever's holding that object is the speaker, the other person listens, you're done, you pass it on. Now you may say that some people may be tempted to hog that object and not relinquish it. But I've not seen that happen in all the therapy I've done this in session too, because what happens is the person who's holding the object becomes consciously aware that they are being a hog. And it starts to stir them up a bit, because it just names it right there. Does that make sense? Some people like to use a little piece of linoleum at a time, because then whoever's holding that has the floor, literally, right? Nice symbolic thing to do. Be ready to listen as well as to talk. Number five, stick to the subject and don't garbage dump. So number one, we're talking about being very specific, thinking behaviorally. We're staying present in no past history, and we are sticking to the subject, which means that someone or both of you need to be a little directive. Some people are very non-directive. They don't like to be too controlling or whatever. But you know, if I am working with a family or whatever, someone in that family needs to be a little directive, or someone or more than one needs to say, we need to stay focused here. What is the subject we're talking about? And keep it on course. Number six, no third parties. Meaning that that you yourself, your opinion, your beliefs, your values, your feelings, your needs are sufficient. And you don't need to bring in the cavalry to support you. You know, Uncle Bob feels the same way about you, you know. Everybody else thinks this way. You know, that's really a sign of kind of you feeling disempowered inside, isn't it? When you have to bring in the opinions of others. No third parties means it is between you and that person that you are having a conflict with. So you don't need to bring in other family members and friends' opinions to support your argument. You are plenty strong and sufficient and valid. No hitting below the belt. What do you think that might mean?
I think it's very individual for issues which are unfair or topics that are topics, but
certain subjects,
certain
areas. Yeah.
And it's awkward because when you said that, I thought about the criticism of my mother.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To me, might be below the belt.
Yes.
But then when your next item is where do you put the belt, sometimes yes. The mother needs to be above the belt.
Yes.
And so for every person, there's a little discerning.
There's a little discerning with that, and we all have below the belt subjects that are not fair fighting, not fair fighting things. I had my mother suffered from an obsessive compulsive disorder. And in her latter years, at times she would regress into states of paranoia. And unfair fighting would have been in a fight, which happened to me in my previous life, where I would be invalidated and told I was being paranoid. And that was quite unfair. When you have someone, for instance, who suffers from mental illness, and that's being put in your face in an attempt to invalidate you in the present, isn't it? That's dirty fighting. No two ways about that. So we all have below the belt subjects, don't we? And that's a pretty normal thing. At the same time, number eight, don't wear the belt around your ears.
Can I stop?
Yes, sir.
I think a way to help think about that is if you think you're going to stick it to somebody, take a little shot here, just take a shot.
Mm-hmm.
That's below the belt.
Yes,
it's kind of self-monitoring. Just not like to say that.
Self-monitoring, awareness of that, and we know that when we're attempting to wound that other person. It's not a constructive thing at all, is it?
Yeah.
Not a constructive thing. And we know that when we're really working on fair fighting, our attitude about conflict has got to be toward resolution.
or it's some kind of dearth with that too. And we'll get more to that too.
This is not, and that's what it says, number 9, this is not a win-lose situation. Think compromise. And I think this is another area where we, in particular, not to pick on, you know, I love America, it's not like I'm anti-American, but I think in the United States we've been really trained to think win-lose. I think we're just, from a very early age, when we get into a conflict, whether it's a war with another country, or whether it's in a sporting event or whatever, we're very competitive people. Very competitive. And most people, when they get into conflict, you know, what makes you think you're going to argue with your partner any differently than you would do something else? You know, if your whole view of conflict has been about competition and domination, you will argue with your partner the same way. So you have to really strive to think win-win. There are some things where you cannot compromise when it hits a core value of yours. So when it says think compromise, there are times where that is not possible, especially if it's right at the core of what you value and believe. But you can still be thinking win-win. You can still think resolution. Yes?
That word compromise, to me, has different connotations. And I'm reflective that we might think, rather than say think compromise, think a more balanced solution. Compromise, in my background, would be I'll give up 6 eggs. That person gives up 2 and we call it even. But then later on, you say, hold on, I gave up 6. He gave up too. I gave up more. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's just an observation about that term. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, compromise is probably not the best term there because some of us have had a history of giving up too much. And you know that when you reflect on it later, that you thought, wow, why did I do that?
But perhaps it's about brainstorming a whole other solution. You know, mm-hmm. Something that neither person has thought about to whatever the issue is. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, is it fair to go back to that person? You know, unless you have given it further thought.
Well, that's where you get into buyer's remorse. Mm-hmm. You know, it was good on Tuesday, now it's Thursday, I have remorse. Mm-hmm. I want to bring it back. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, thinking, and just compromise gives me a connotation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the more bad experiences we've had with that, that makes sense too, doesn't it? Number 10, remember who you are fighting with. That sounds like an obvious thing. You know, none of us are schizophrenic or whatever and go space out. But at times, we can get into an argument and we can act out a lot of our earlier conflicts in life, and maybe we're arguing as if we were arguing with our parent, with a previous spouse or whatever. And it's really important to stay very focused on who we are arguing with. And it's very important to stay focused that this person, if it's one who is very close to us, to stay very focused that this is a precious relationship to us. And that our words are very powerful, aren't they, at times? Don't walk out on an argument. There are some exceptions to that, too. You find that if you're arguing with someone, if they're breaking several of these rules, you know, it is tough to take a time out from that argument, isn't it? It's okay to do time outs. It's okay, and cool off a bit and come back to the conflict later. In fact, one of the things I really want you to know, I think is important, is that conflict in our lives comes up very spontaneously, doesn't it? Throughout the day, at any point in time. Frequently, conflicts come up when we are hungry, tired, feeling discouraged, lonely, all those kinds of things. And is that a good time to do resolution? Not at all. No, you don't. You know, when you're in that kind of situation, it's probably not going to go well. Conflict comes up spontaneously. Conflict resolution needs to be a much more intentional, kind of planful thing. And that's another area where I think that if you do a notebook, I think that's very helpful. Because if you have a notebook, when a conflict comes up, at some point in time, you can go back and you can pick up the notebook and jot down what the argument was about before you forget it, right? And then what you need to do is you need to have a time where the two of you will have a time where you're rested, uninterrupted, well-fed, all those things are going to be in a pretty, and have the time to work through it. And then sit down, And be centered and really try and work through that. Have you ever had that experience where you've done that?
It's a lot more constructive that way.
Let me see if I got this right. You're feeling good. You both had lunch. Everything's really peaceful in the house.
Yes.
Somebody's going to run over and grab his notebook. And we're going to go to
Let's have a fight.
That's a good idea.
You know, it's interesting that we have the reaction because people believe conflict is bad. It's like, well, why mess with this utopia? Why mess with this balance that we have right now?
Well, I'll show that Paul and I were doing this very thing earlier, before this workshop, about our parenting. It's like, you know, Paul, when we get back down lake, as I've learned to say, we need to put those torch hearts back up at home. And we're sitting there trying to solve issues that are not necessarily conflict between me and Paul, but with our four kids, about who's not doing it. Anybody relate to this, you know? So we did take a time here at Fulton, and we intended to talk about this, because it is a source of stress in our family. Mm-hmm. Who's pulling the load, who's not pulling the load. You know, so I know you don't want, it takes courage and commitment to stir it up again.
It does.
And
it's the kind of thing, I'm reminded of our oldest son, who would prefer, if it were left up to him, to never talk about a problem. He's a major conflict avoider that way. And that would be his attitude too, is that there's no good time to talk about a problem, you know? Whereas if we think of ourselves as kind of like a corporation, we're a company, as a group of people together, what company wouldn't have a weekly meeting where they sit down and talk about the issues at hand? You have weekly meetings.
I don't think that's a good question.
If a company's going to be well run, you need to have some sort of weekly meeting, though, don't you? And families, any of you have family meetings or anything like that?
And my wife and I will if it's getting tense on something, try to figure out another time to do it. And it could be 2 or 3 weeks out.
Yes.
You know, because that's a tough one. I got to think about it. One of us may say, all right, let's pick a time and kind of do it then.
Very, very true. And it's not to, you know, to be assertive and work through these things, there's no time limit. And especially if you've written something in the notebook or whatever, or your journal, you're not going to forget it. And it's okay to go back 2 or 3 weeks out after you've had a chance to kind of gather your thoughts and feelings. Any of you taken the Myers-Briggs personality test here? Mm-hmm. I test as an INFP on the Myers-Briggs, which means that I'm an introverted, intuitive, feeling, perceiving person, which means, in Myers-Briggs terms, that I'm probably the worst person at conflict in terms of just my natural temperament. Very disempowered kind of place to be. Introverted, meaning that I'm not always clear on what I'm thinking and feeling at the time. I have to reflect on it first. Feeling, meaning that I have a tendency to struggle too much with the unsettled feelings, the anger and frustration, all those things. Intuitive, meaning that sometimes when I'm in an argument, I don't always have 2 or 3 solid facts to back up my argument. I just have kind of a gut feeling about it, you know? So for me, what you're saying, Terry, is really important, because I've had to give myself permission to go back, think it out, sort it out, come get clarity on my thinking, you know, my thoughts and feelings. Also get some idea of what I'd like to see happen as a solution. It's okay to formulate some solutions in our brain in the meantime. Some people, when they formulate a solution, are really locked into it, though, and they are headed for a control battle, aren't they? So I always tell people, have some ideas of what you think would be a good solution. At the same time, have some flexibility about that, too. So you don't get locked into a real control, kind of stubborn, concrete fight, right? Yes, sir.
Yeah, a couple of things. I think a lot of this feels awkwardly practicing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know?
And the other piece about the timeout, seems to me that it's real important to talk about when you get back together again.
Yes.
Intentional about that, because when you're walking out, and there's no intention to come back again. Don't do that.
Those are very good points. Thank you. If you take a time out, which I suggest when people are breaking rules, or especially in families where there's a threat of anything physical going on, you still need to give that person some time frame. You don't just say the heck with you and slam the door, and the other person has the tremendous feeling of abandonment they have to deal with, right? There needs to be some indication that let's take a time out for half an hour, I need to cool. We'll get back to this. That's a civil way to do it. We're learning civility here, aren't we? At the same time, as you're saying, what is your first name?
Peter.
Peter, I really appreciate your comments. We're saying also that when you do these things, it is awkward. It's very, for some, it's very natural. It's like riding your bicycle the first time when you're 6 years old, right? Were you smooth at that? Did you fall off the bike? Skin your knee?
Didn't hurt.
Did you get back on the bike and with determination and saying, I'm going to try again? Give yourself permission to be, to learn. Give yourself permission to be a work in progress, right? It is all about progress, not perfection. Living is. We cannot achieve any perfection. So if you're not real skilled at conflict, do your best to prepare, do some homework, get some ideas on your thoughts and feelings, jot them down. Right, you know, for me as an introvert, I do conflict better if I've written out notes. Sometimes with difficult interventions, where I'm afraid or concerned the other person's really not going to hear it well and going to respond maybe even with rage, I write a letter. And you know what, that's okay to do that. Some would say, well, that's kind of cowardly, isn't it, writing a letter? For me, I can sort out my thoughts and feelings a lot better, and it works better. And the other person has a chance to respond. Of course they do. You ever write a letter as a way of handling conflict? Sometimes that helps too. So, don't walk out in an argument. Number 12, hold hands. You know what? I've never done that. I don't know if that's possible. I don't think we've ever done that in a conflict.
No, but I'll tell you what you have done to me, especially early on in our relationship. We're doing this better. He would say, let's pray. And I would go, no. I may calm down if you pray. I wanted to yell. You've done that.
That belief that you were more powerful, yelling perhaps.
I got one, when you look at your partner and say, let's pray. Yeah.
Well, let's pray. Rule 6.
What is your name, sir? You know, I'm so glad you're here, but it does smile. It's a presumed third party, of course. We presume that since God is in the burning bush, God is everywhere, even in these little chipmunks that people aren't quite so thrilled about out here, that God is in the presence of the two. And you know, to me, so much of relationship struggle comes down to a battle of the wills, isn't it? Your will versus my will. It's a battle of the wills. And how can we transcend? What better way can we transcend a battle of the wills between two people other than to focus on God's will and pray at the onset of trying to do conflict resolution? What better way to do that? And you're right, it does calm you down.
So now I do it. I still don't want to. But I will, and it helps. Prayer helps. It does.
Prayer does help because, you know,
help us to put the right words.
We get dug in. I do think as Americans, we tend to struggle with being a little spoiled in our country, and we tend to want things our way. We want what we want, and we want it now, and all those things that our culture promotes. And sometimes in conflict, we can be kind of like spoiled children who want things our way, get pretty stubborn, have temper tantrums. Some people do big anger, and they think that that's tough, or they think it's powerful. And I like to tell, especially for men who struggle with it, I like to reframe their temper and anger or rage as a temper tantrum, which sometimes they don't like, because it's really kind of saying, you know, it's a bit of 2-year-old behavior to do that, isn't it? But, you know, for some people, they learned at a very early age that anger works. It's a method of control, isn't it? When they're 2 years old and they had a tantrum in the checkout aisle at the grocery store because they wanted a candy bar and their mom didn't want to give it to them, and that tantrum was reinforced because the parent was embarrassed and wanted to shut this kid up and gave them the candy. They learned. They took that big step toward learning that anger is an effective method of controlling other people. It's not about power. It's about control and domination. And some people still struggle with temper tantrums on into their 30s and 40s, don't they? Yes, sir.
Let's say I'm just going to vent. I'm just going to get big and noisy about this, and then they'll say, well, I'm over it, you know. Mm-hmm. Is there a space that where venting isn't?
You know, venting, that's an interesting thing. I think venting at times is needed. Venting is not part of the conflict resolution process, though, is it? And venting doesn't even need to necessarily occur directly to that person. You know, we can vent, we have a punching bag in our backyard hanging from our tree that our younger son, Travis, who is here with us, he's an INFP also, so he internalizes a lot of stuff. But when he gets upset and tense, he'll go out in the backyard and he'll just punch the heck out of that punching bag. It's a good way for him to vent. What's wrong with that? And he comes back in.
We all
hear it. Travis is venting. He comes back in, he's a little more centered, and he's willing to talk then, generally, you know? And that's a healthy thing. Venting to that other person isn't always a productive thing.
Unless, I would say if the other person doesn't mind, if that's your contract in your marriage, that one person vents and the other person doesn't soak it up, and that's okay. I mean, I've been upset and just told you how
you have resentful
vented. I feel like one of the
I have vented.
Yeah, I think it depends on whether how that is in terms of a conflict in a couple.
But often I just feel venting about a, you know, a teenager who got my buttons and is pushing me.
No.
Or I'm allowing them to be pushed. You know, and then I feel a bit about the person. But I don't know that I'm thoughtful of, you know, I just need 2 minutes here.
Yes.
Because I really don't want to do this in front of this 19-year-old. I want to do it, you know, before I get there.
You know, it's, absolutely. Because sometimes the venting is a hurtful thing. And sometimes we just get stuck. Some people get stuck in that kind of groove of just venting, and they don't make the shift to proactive problem solving. Some people just stay stuck in a venting kind of complaining groove. And don't let that happen to you. Be proactive people who are oriented toward solutions and aren't just stuck with in a groove of venting. That's not a good place to be. Number 13 on this list, for your information, is meant as a joke, okay? It is humor. But there may be some times where that is helpful too. Rules of fair fighting, does that all make sense to you? Next thing I want to talk about is, how are we doing time-wise here, Jane? Okay, next thing I want to talk about has to do with just the process of conflict resolution. I want you to come to see conflict as a process. In fact, frequently, for me as a counselor, when I'm watching people argue in front of me, there are two things to consider, the content and the process. The content is the stuff they're arguing about. It's the subject, right? The process is how the machine is working, how they're communicating, whether they're validating each other, whether they're sharing power equally, whether they're looking for solutions. That's kind of how the machine is operating. You've got this conflict resolution machine in your brain. Content gets dropped into it. You're fighting over some subject. The content, to me, as a therapist, is actually almost irrelevant. Not that I don't listen to it, I do. I listen to the content, but I observe the process. Because the process is what we really have the power to, and that's really where the fundamental shift and change needs to take place. So what I'm looking for in process is, how are these people communicating back and forth? Are they taking turns? Are they validating each other? Are they clarifying with their communication, clarifying perceptions and needs, putting it out on the table? Are they starting to look for solutions? You ever think of communication as both process and content? I'd like for you just to kind of plant a seed about that, to start thinking of that when you enter into a conversation of any kind. Start thinking about observing the process of stepping back. Yeah, and it's kind of like developing a third ear, is really what it is. Stepping back and listening to, observing the process of how this machine is operating. And if one or both of you in a relationship are good at doing that, you'll catch yourself when you start going down the wrong path. You'll catch yourself in a lot of the frustrating kind of bad habits that we all have. Bless you. Any questions about just that whole idea of what process is? When I look at process in terms of conflict, I am thinking the importance early on in the person stating their initial position. So they're stating their needs, their feelings, and their thoughts. Pushy person who gets their way, that is not assertiveness. It's not aggressive. Assertiveness is being good, very skilled, at stating your thoughts, your feelings, and your needs. Some people are really good at doing that. Some people are good at doing one of those areas, but not so good at the other. Some people, for instance, are just kind of almost unaware of their needs. And they, in the conflict, they just don't put it out there because they don't think that way. Some people were raised not to consider their own needs. Anybody raised that way? Your own needs were not all that important. That's a situation that is true more for females than males. Because you all were raised, many of you, to consider the needs of others rather than your own needs. And you are disempowered that way. Because when we go into conflict, we have our sword of truth in conflict. And part of our sword of truth is our ability to define these three things and be able to do it well.
I like that image you use of swordplay. I imagine Romeo and Juliet, you know, when they're that sword scene, mm-hmm. they're doing it well and everybody's skillful.
You know, it helps me to think of it that way because it's kind of a civil sort of fencing kind of duel that you do when you're doing healthy conflict. And you expect the other person to do that with you. If you're fighting with someone who invalidates you, it is like they are pulling out their machete and just hacking to pieces your little fencing sword. And that's not a fun kind of conflict. So one of the things that you need to be able to be very skilled at doing in conflict is to be able to state your thoughts, feelings, and needs. Okay. The next the handout coming around is just a little handout on words that describe feelings. This is one of my favorite. I've seen lots of lists of feeling words. This is my favorite one. In fact, I think this handout is worth the price of admission here today. It is so good. There was a great fine movie called, My Breakfast with Andre?
My Dinner with Andre.
My Dinner with Andre? Yeah, I forgot what meal it was. But the one line from that movie that I remember so well from My Dinner with Andre is, we need a language of the heart. Because our words fall so short, don't they? But our words are all we have. And if you want to be a skilled person, you want to really have a good knowledge of the language of the heart and be skilled at it. And I think a lot of people, intelligent people, are crippled in this area. And the only way to get it is to practice it and know it. I do a lot of anger management classes for adolescents. And the first question I ask the group of adolescents is, give me some words to communicate anger. Synonyms for anger. And every time I ask them, there's dead silence in the group. It's like they don't have any. And then the first word they will say is, you know, usually pissed off. I can almost count on it every time. You know, how articulate are you, you know? You want to be a masterful conflict resolutionist and communicate your heart, commit to learning some of these words. And I recommend that you learn the 8 basic core human feelings are the words in boldface down there. You can look at those. Those are the 8 basic Crayola crayons that we started out with in our box of 8, right? When we started coloring, those 8 basic feelings. And then when you want to get beyond that, learn some of the words that fine-tune it underneath it. For instance, under anger, there are 15 words that fine-tune the feeling of anger. Can you see that? Now, one thing you can notice about underneath anger is that these words that fine-tune anger are of varying intensity. You can put a dimmer switch on your anger. You don't have to have an on-off switch like a lot of people do. Put a dimmer switch on your anger so you can be precise. So you can tell someone that you're feeling irritated and annoyed. Or you can tell someone when you're feeling furious. You've got some control. You can do what we call modulation. That's what we call it in therapy. To modulate our affect is to have the right word to be precise with it. Does that make sense? So I would recommend in conflict that you have like 6 words under anger that you know like the back of your hand. And you can use them right at that moment in time and they fit pretty much the intensity that you feel and that you know the other core feelings too. An important part of conflict resolution. Yes, sir?
Well, I was just thinking how you've been working all day, you drive home, you got the work frustrations, the kids then bombard you as soon as you get in the door. Mm-hmm. Then your spouse comes up to you and you read the mail. There's like four ways of responding to those sorts of situations, you know? And so this is nice. I'm thinking, yeah, great, me and my wife can do it. My background was as a trial lawyer. They never would say the joke, I feel hurt by your statement. You know, it's like, I guess contextually, and it's like, I just keep thinking this is great, but it's in just that personal relationship.
Our how to take relationships.
It, yeah, how to take it bigger.
Yes.
You know, Jerry, I would offer you, I've got to share this, I know we're almost out of time, that what you're feeling in that moment, maybe I'm wrong, is inadequate to handle all of this junk in your life at that moment. Kind of, I want to share with you, we were at a workshop where Paul and I said, how many people in this room have ever felt inadequate? Every single woman raised their hand, and none of the men did. And Paul was like, hey guys, hey, let's get real here, you know. Inadequacy is a feeling that men aren't in touch with. I never saw it like I did that day.
Inadequacy, fear, sometimes sadness. Those are feelings that men are is in touch with, because we were not perhaps allowed those feelings, and it wasn't.
Women have more permission to feel inadequate.
Yeah, just to round out a couple things here, in terms of process, stating your needs and feelings. Clarification is the second basic step. And this is the only thing I want to say about clarification, is I want you to think of communication as a sculpting process. It isn't just that I put one thought out there and that's to be understood as we've accurately communicated with each other. I expect people to misunderstand each other. I expect people to misstate what they really think and feel. So clarification is like sculpting. It's like if we have an idea between us, you ask me questions back to get, or you restate it, you paraphrase, we go back and forth in that until we've sculpted that idea to something that we both see and understand. Give yourself permission to sculpt in the second phase so that you can clarify one another.
And does paraphrasing really key in there? Is that like a tool for clarification? Can you paraphrase? Do you mirror back?
Absolutely. Mirroring Hendricks, in Harville Hendricks' books, he calls it mirroring. And it can be just as simple as stating back, just almost verbatim what the other person has said, which, you know, a lot of people tease therapists because we make money doing that. People, you know? What I hear you say is, you know, well, anybody can do that, but you know what, people don't. And they misunderstand each other all the time. The third basic step here, after clarification, is to start to look at possible solutions. And when it comes to brainstorming solutions, initially you brainstorm. What you eventually want to work to is to developing a strategy or a plan, or what you can call a list of doables. Make sure that your plan that you have in conflict resolution includes some doable things, some specific behavioral things that you can do, be very specific, write it out, have them be attainable things. Don't just have this be an exercise in futility. So have the plan that you have be fairly concrete in things that you know you can accomplish. Also, set it up in such a way that you know you will be able, that you will follow through on it too. Have some accountability to your plan, so that you can go back to the next meeting. Like if you had a corporate meeting, you would do this old business time. There's old business, right? Where you're going to reflect back a week or a month later and say, how are we doing on this? Change is not easy. You must persist, you must be focused, and you must be patient to bring about change in your life. And if you don't, it won't happen. Does that make sense? Tomorrow, if you are here or wherever, I'm not sure where we're meeting at tomorrow, but I'm going to be taking us a step further, taking us further through the conflict resolution process into what is referred to as emptying, the third stage of intimacy, okay? God bless you all. Thanks for doing it. Yes, sir. I'll stick around here if you have other questions, too. Yes.